This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are probably running one of the last open hospitals in Khartoum. So for sure, our presence in Khartoum as NSF, I mean, we are the only international actor still remaining there.
That's Christopher Garnier, MSF's emergency manager for Sudan. Details coming up. Also, the World Health Organization is urging action to prevent and control dengue. And a Malawi court has convicted a Chinese national of racial discrimination against children. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The World Health Organization is urging action to prevent and control dengue, which is spreading to more regions and countries due to the increased movement of people, urbanization, and climate-related issues. Lisha Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Health Agency reports dengue, which is spread by the Aedes species of mosquito, has grown dramatically worldwide in recent decades. It warns that about half of the world's population is now at risk of dengue. So far this year, it says the American region has reported nearly 3 million cases of the disease, and the virus-spreading mosquito has firmly established itself in more than 24 European countries. Head of WHO's Global Neglected Tropical Diseases Program, Raman Velayudhan, says in Africa, Sudan has reported more than 8,200 cases and 45 deaths since July 2022. And he says cases have been reported in Egypt in recent weeks. He calls the situation in Africa of concern. He says the more than 200,000 cases reported from the region every year is likely underestimated. He says there must be a better job of recording the number of dengue cases in Africa.
We know it is there, but it has been masked by other diseases. But now that malaria in particular has made great strides and has reduced in Africa, we are seeing increasing presence of dengue. And this is something we really encourage the governments, and we are trying to build capacities to make sure that the recording system begins to report dengue cases. And it is happening.
He says WHO is tracking cases of the disease that have been reported in Sudan, Ethiopia, parts of Senegal, Kenya, Nigeria, and Sao Tome. Velayudhan says WHO is trying to alert governments of the need to take preventive measures to control the spread of the disease. This, he says, is of particular importance right now in Asia, where the monsoon season is about to begin. He notes high precipitation, increased temperature, and even water scarcity favor mosquitoes. He says all regions where these conditions exist are advised to take similar measures.
So we really need to be better prepared and make sure that all our health facilities are well alerted. And as the water recedes, we need to prevent breeding. And this is the key message. And communities can do a great help by just going round in and round their houses to clean whatever stagnant water is there and to make sure that mosquitoes are not breeding in and around their house.
Dengue, which is the most common viral infection that spreads from mosquitoes to people, thrives in tropical and subtropical climates. WHO says most people with dengue do not have symptoms and get better in 1 to 2 weeks. However, it says people who develop severe cases need hospital care as it could be fatal. While there's no specific treatment for dengue, it says patients can be treated with medicines to lower the temperature and ease pain. The mosquito that transmits dengue tends to bite during the day, so WHO advises people to cover up during the day to lower their risk of being bitten. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A court in Malawi has ordered a Chinese national to leave the country in 7 days after it found him guilty of racial discrimination against children. The court has sentenced 26-year-old Liu Qi to 1 year in prison for selling exploitative videos of Malawian children. State lawyers say Lu Qi has since paid his victims compensation, but Malawian child rights campaigners say the punishment is not enough. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
This sentence comes after prosecutors decided to amend some of the charges against Lu Qi. Lu Qi, also known as Susu, was initially charged with child trafficking, illegal use of the internet, and procurement of children for use of entertainment, among other charges. Lu Qi denied those charges, saying the aim of the videos was to help spread Chinese culture to the local community. Dzikondi Antumalunda is the state lawyer.
And after all that was concluded is when some charges were withdrawn, and he agreed to plead guilty to the charges and also to pay sums of money as compensation to those children that were affected by his criminal acts.
Malunda also said the compensation of 16 million kwacha, or $16,000, that Lu Qi paid was meant for general community benefits, such as drilling a well in case there is none. In his ruling, Principal Resident Magistrate Roderick Michongwe said Lu Qi had already served the 12-month sentence during the time he was remanded in prison since June of last year.
It is part of the agreement that a convict will leave the country within 7 days and will not return to Malawi again.
Police arrested Lu Qi last year following his extradition from Zambia, where he fled after a British Broadcasting Corporation investigation reported he was recording young villagers in central Malawi and make them say racist things about themselves in Mandarin. In one video, children as young as 9 were heard saying in Mandarin that they are a black monster and have a low IQ. The BBC reported he was selling the videos at up to $70 apiece to a Chinese website. The children in the videos were paid about $0.50 each. The news sparked outrage in Malawi, prompting some rights organizations to hold street protests and present a petition to the Chinese embassy in the capital of Lilongwe. In the petition, protesters asked the Chinese government to compensate the children in the videos for being fooled to say words in a foreign language they could not understand. Comfort Mangwazi is the former president of the University of Malawi Child Rights Legal Clinic, which led the protests. She told VOA via a messaging app that the sentencing has got the clinic off guard. She said they needed to see the official charge sheet.
We need to interrogate how the 16 million kwacha came about, the criteria used to arrive to such an amount, and why it was considered adequate, and how and if all of the children have been identified, and how the children themselves actually feel about all of this, about this settlement.
A rights campaigner, Matthews Gajani, led a protest of Lu Qi's conduct last year. He said the sentence given to Lu Qi is disappointing.
He exploited Malawian children. He demeaned not only the children themselves, but the black race, which becomes now a racism issue. It also becomes a sexual exploitation issue. So you see some of the pictures of Susu holding young girls and all that. So we consider this a very serious issue. And for him to be given a 12-month sentence doesn't make any sense to us.
Lu Qi's lawyer did not respond to a text sent by VOA seeking his comment on the matter. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
A week-long heat wave will intensify this weekend, pushing temperatures here in the United States near 130 degrees Fahrenheit. The global heat wave has focused attention on the costs of addressing climate change. In Africa, some students are learning about what drives climate change, including actions in their own communities, like cutting down trees for fuel. Now, children are stepping up to reverse the effects of those activities. Chris Makulu is the East African Regional Director of the NGO World Neighbors. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam it's important to make kids understand the gravity of the situation and learn about ways they can help save the planet while they are young.
In East Africa, we made it very clear that we needed to begin to influence people when they are young to appreciate the importance of taking care of the environment, particularly trees, given the global warming problem.
So what are these kids in the schools doing in Kenya with the trees?
Yes, so we went to, in the communities where we work, we go to schools, and with the support of the school administration, form what we call school environmental clubs. And the environmental clubs in the school consist of both boys and girls who are interested in environmental management and conservation. So we train them on how to establish tree nurseries where they can plant seeds, and then they become seedlings, which they can then plant in the school in what are called woodlots, school woodlots, a small forest within the school. But we don't want it to end just at the school level. We want them to transfer this attitude and skills to their own homes. So we follow them up with when they go home and talk with their parents, and therefore they also develop and plant or establish a woodlot, some small forest, some woodlot within their homes. We don't just end at the school, but we want it to get into the community so mm-hmm. that we increase the tree cover, which is very, very low in most African countries.
I imagine that you're using seedlings that are of trees that are the fast growing type.
Yes. And secondly, we ensure that they also have what you call fruit trees, like mangoes, like papaya, because then it would be an incentive to plant trees, not just for timber, but also for eating, for food. But we go for fast maturing, like grevillea, like casuarina. And these days we also want to, once they begin to take root, we also want to introduce indigenous trees, which are whose seeds are almost getting extinct. But we begin with fast maturing ones.
Do the kids seem receptive to this? Do you have a lot of children that are taking part in this, in these clubs?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They are very interested because some of them, you know, they know that, you know, they can, it is also an income generating activity, because when they have, you know, enough seedlings or more than enough, they can sell some to community members who cannot establish their own tree nurseries. So they come to buy from these students. And so they see it, apart from just managing the environment well, it is also an income-generating activity. So most of them are very, very committed to it, yes.
Where in Kenya is this happening, and is it happening in any other countries in Africa?
Yes, where we work. Like, you know, we work in East Africa. We work currently in four countries in East Africa: Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and currently we are moving. We are moving into Malawi.
That's Chris Makulu, East African Regional Director of the NGO World Neighbors. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. UN Special Envoy to Libya, Abdoulaye Batili, met with National Oil Company Chair Farhat Omar Bin Gadar to discuss the distancing the oil company from politics. Batili said oil should not be used as a weapon in political disputes and that exports must continue. General Khalifa Haftar, the dominant power in eastern Libya, has stepped up pressure on the Tripoli-based government of national unity to come up with another formula for sharing the oil cash. Wolfgang Porsta, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, I would say this is the very usual demand frequently voiced, especially by Western diplomats and by Western politicians and by UNSMIL. This demand is understandably, especially from the point of view by the nations who are buying oil from Libya, but I'm not so sure about all the Libyans themselves. Actually, oil revenues always have been a main tool for the governments in Tripoli to stay in power ever since the revolution in 2011. And its distribution is perceived very unfair in the East and in the South. An example. Just recently, while Prime Minister Dabeiba opened the fun park in Misrata, his hometown, which allegedly costed 42 million Libyan dinar, the hospitals in Sepa, the capital of Fezzan, are short of any kind of medical equipment and run out of medications. Guess what the people in Sepa say about the fun park in Misrata. During the Libyan civil war, tribal leaders in the east complained that the government in Tripoli is killing their children with weapons bought from their oil wealth. Furthermore, corruption is a big issue. Libya currently ranks 171 out of 180 countries in the Corruption Perception Index of Transparency International, gliding down the slope from what was already a very corrupt regime before the revolution. People in the east and people in the south say the people in Tripolitania are using our oil wealth to get it into their own pockets. So actually, access to oil revenues decides who is ruling the country. And this is, of course, a very political question. So such a call for not using oil in Libyan politics is considered by many in the east and south as a support of the Dabeiba government and the support for the corrupt political class. People claim for the United Nations and for the West, anything is acceptable in Libya as long as the oil is flowing.
Speaking before his top commanders in eastern Libya, General Khalifa Haftar, the dominant power in eastern Libya, stepped up his pressure on the Tripoli-based government of national unity to come up with another formula for sharing the oil cash. He demanded that a high-level committee must be established to allocate funds in a fair manner and warned that if such committee fails to take over the allocation of funds fairly for all Libyans, Libyans will be ready to demand their legitimate rights. What do you make of that?
This mirrors the deep frustration of what in the East and South is, as said, perceived as an unjust distribution of Libya's oil wealth, especially in the light that the vast majority of Libya's oil and gas is located in Fezzan and in Cyrenaica. Just a couple of days after Haftar's speech early July, the Presidential Council established a National Supreme Financial Committee. All Libyan parties should be represented in this committee, and the committee should ensure an equal distribution of the revenues and also strengthen the confidence in the fairness of this distribution process. It is chaired by the Presidential Council Chairman Mohamed Al-Menfi himself, with the Chairman of the National Oil Corporation, Omar Bin Gadara, as a deputy. And Prime Minister Dabeiba pledged his full support for this. The international community praised the establishment of this committee. The first meeting took place last Thursday in Sirte, and at the closing statement, they demanded to get accurate data from the NOC, from the Central Bank of Libya and the Libyan Foreign Bank, accurate data on state revenues to be able to fulfill their tasks. I would say the establishment of this committee is undoubtedly a very positive step. However, it remains to be seen whether they will be really able to carry out their task.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1202-258-3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a report we did that mattered to you. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa, or tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. That number, again, is +1202-258-3076. Tell us your name and where you live, and you might hear your comments on our shows. And thanks for 60 years of support. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu today announced the creation of a new infrastructure fund. Reuters News Service says it's part of a series of measures to boost the economy and ease the inflationary impact of his decision to scrap an expensive petrol subsidy. The president's office says the new infrastructure support fund will help Nigeria's 36 states boost transportation, including upgrades of farm-to-market roads. It will also fund health, education, power and water projects. No details were given on how it will be funded. The announcement comes a day after the government unveiled a program to distribute free grains and subsidized fertilizer. Reuters says Tinubu has been under pressure to offer relief to households and small businesses after he scrapped a popular petrol subsidy, which kept fuel prices cheap for decades, but cost the government $10 billion last year. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From the earliest days of the Russian invasion of its neighbor, Russia unleashed a campaign of gross and systematic violations against Ukraine's civilian population. An avalanche of evidence supports thousands of reports of crimes against humanity and war crimes, ranging from attacks on civilian infrastructure, including schools and hospitals, to appalling violence against civilians and outright murder of Ukrainian non-combatants. When it comes to justice and accountability for these crimes, there are five pathways to justice, said United States Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice Beth Van Schaak at a special briefing. First, there is the International Criminal Court.
We've seen the prosecutor make his first move, successfully achieving two arrest warrants for very senior figures within Russia, focused on the deportation of children from Ukraine and temporarily controlled or occupied areas into Russia, often to very far-flung places, and subjecting those children to adoption or other situations, notwithstanding that they have loved ones, guardians, families who want them back.
Second, are cases within the Ukrainian national courts, said Ambassador Van Schaak.
The Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group, which is a joint initiative of the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union, is fully operational on the ground. We have deployed a number of experts to work side by side with their Ukrainian counterparts to help sift through the now tens of thousands of recorded potential war crimes and other atrocities.
Third, European countries are opening investigations for those cases when individual perpetrators may end up within their borders or within their jurisdictional reach. Fourth, an international center that will support nations already building cases against senior Russian leaders for the crime of aggression resulting from the country's invasion of Ukraine, opened in The Hague on July 3rd. And finally, the United States Attorney General has stood up a war crimes accountability team. WARCAT, it's called, said Ambassador Van Schaak.
We have a dedicated war crimes accountability team that is looking at cases that might have some kind of a U.S. nexus and be able to proceed here in U.S. courts under the new legal authorities that Congress has provided.
If Russia had not chosen to invade its sovereign neighbor, we would not see the terrible war crimes happening on the ground, said Ambassador Van Schaak. And so it's quite important for Ukraine to see this crime prosecuted.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.